Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets. My not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. A blustery night here in the desert tonight. We're really having our own version of a Scirocco sweeping across the valley here, stirring up the ragweed and cheatgrass, shooting across from Pie Town and the wildfires of San Bernardino. Hope all you folks listening tonight in Southern California are back safe in your homes. And to our listeners in Louisiana, our hearts go out to you. I hope folks will dig deep and help out with what they can. And this being a hot and windy outside night here in the West seems like a great night to stay indoors and listen to the radio. Or maybe you're driving tonight, slicing through the darkness somewhere. We got something to keep you not only occupied, but on the edge of your seats. I'm not positive, but I'm beginning to think that Nick Redfern might be an alien or a possible time traveler from the future. To call him prolific is really on the modest side. The guy must write books in his sleep, if he sleeps. He is one of the best paranormal, cryptozoological conspiracy writers out there, always coming up with new and interesting angles on topics familiar to Coast listeners, and tonight, he's outdone himself. You've heard of the MIBs, of course, the Men in Black, and I don't mean Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith as the fictional agents with the offbeat humor in those MIB movies. I mean the original version, these weird, not quite human characters who always seem out of place, out of time, that wear strange clothes, maybe wigs. They show up at the homes of people who've had strange experiences, UFO encounters, or they hassle researchers who are digging into things that maybe the MIBs think they shouldn't be chasing. The Men in Black, I think, will represent one of the most inexplicable sort of side stories of the whole UFO era. Turns out, there are also women in black. In fact, they're more chilling than their male counterparts. Why does that not surprise me? Nick Redfern has a new book about true firsthand encounters with the women in black, and this might be the creepiest book he's ever written. I say that in the best possible, most complimentary way, because these stories will make the hair on your neck get up and walk down the block. Nick is here for the first half of tonight's program, and then in the second half, we explore the life of a giant, a colossus in the world of metaphysics. His name was Manly Palmer Hall, and he was like a rock star of the L.A. metaphysics scene for decades. He captured the attention of everyone from Elvis and Ronald Reagan to John Denver and Osama bin Laden. A newly expanded book about Manly Hall has been written by a journalist from the L.A. Times, and it's a spellbinding piece of work. If you're interested in the Rosicrucians, the Freemasons, the larger esoteric arts, which included for a while seers and charlatans over the decades in Hollywood and elsewhere, I think you'll really enjoy this book and the interview with its author, Louis Sahagun, making his first visit to Coast, and I hope I didn't butcher his name too badly. We'll try to get the pronunciation right. Can't wait to dive into that. Our webmaster Lex and I have put together our usual collection of oddities and items culled from various news sources around the world. We call it Knapp's News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast website. One story featured there tonight is something that I've covered many times over the years, so I have a personal interest in it. It's not a positive development about wild horses. You know, some of you may recall we interviewed Madeline Pickens on this program. She was the wife of billionaire T. Boone Pickens, no longer married. But she had this dream about building a wild horse sanctuary in northern Nevada on this gigantic cattle ranch. It's almost 600,000 acres, what used to be a cattle ranch anyway. She's tried to put this thing together, turn it into an eco-resort, spent 7 years, $25 million, and has faced all kinds of opposition from the BLM, which won't let her open, the cattle ranching community, the local officials there. Well, a week ago, somebody sneaked onto her private property It's way out in the middle of nowhere, where she had a herd of horses and a 12,000-acre enclosure, plenty of room for them. Whoever did this cut the fences, sabotaged the gates, and disabled all of the water sources for this herd of Mustangs. Dozens of horses just kind of vanished. They're gone. Another dozen or more died of thirst. Now, that's a bad way to go. So whoever did this, I mean, this is really a rotten thing to do. There was no other water source out there for many, many miles, so they died in the summer heat. And the video and the photos are horrible. Mrs. Pickens is now offering a reward of $100,000 for information about this heinous crime. So anyone listening who might be living up there in Elko County who's heard about this, who knows anything, we're talking to you. 100 grand for the information leading to the arrest and conviction for whoever did this. We've got a news story posted on the website. It's graphic stuff, so be forewarned, but check it out if you've got the stomach for it. Also there, speculation about what aliens might actually look like might not be what you'd expect after seeing so many alien invasion movies over the decades. Also got a piece from Time magazine about the emergence of, well, I guess what you'd call internet trolls. Anytime you go online or social media or Twitter or Facebook, no matter what you publish, it ticks somebody off. And people say things online and write things they would never say to your face. Some are saying it's the apparent death of civility. I think you all know the kind of people we're talking about. There's a piece that explores this new development. Also, have you watched the new Netflix series, Stranger Things? I just started it, so I have no idea where it's heading, but we've got a story tonight that gives kind of a hint. It's about exploring a topic that we've discussed here many times, the idea of parallel dimensions, alternate realities. How likely are those ideas? Is that even possible? Is that doable? Is it more than just sci-fi? Check out those stories and more on our NAPS News section, and while you're there on the Coast website, take a look at how to become a Coast Insider. It's still a great deal. It costs about 15 cents a day. You can get access to a vast archive of programs. Listen anytime you want, as many times as you want, on whatever device you've got. You can also subscribe to George Norrie's TV program, Beyond Belief, there. We've got a link on the website. Take a look at that and more while you're visiting. And with that, let's get ready to snuggle up with some very unusual company, the Women in Black. You know the drill, folks. Bring in the dog and cat, fluff up the pillow for them, slide your bod into those silky jammies, wedge your toes into the bunny slippers, pour a big hot cup of Joe, turn down the lights, turn up the radio, and plop down in that Barca lounger. In a moment, chilling tales of the Women in Black with Nick Redfern. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. Stories about the Men in Black, beyond the ones that you know from the popular movies, first burst into the American consciousness, I think, back in the 50s and 60s. Researchers like John Keel and a few other early pioneers chased down some of these stories. A few of them even had their own encounters. Less publicized, but perhaps more intense and spookier, are the stories about the Women in Black. And these gals don't take a backseat to anyone when it comes to weirdness. Nick Redfern has tracked down a book full of really strange and well-documented tales, and it's always a good night when I can say that my guest is Nick Redfern. Nick, good to have you back.
Hey, George. How's it going?
Hey, so this, you didn't write this because of some bad experience you had with a woman, some date that didn't work out, right?
No, I actually didn't, no.
Do you remember the moment when you decided this could be its own book? Because I'm sure you probably have heard little bits and pieces of these stories over the years.
Yeah, well, what happened was that between 2006 and last year, I've written three books on the Men in Black. And obviously, you know, when you write a book on a particular subject, people contact you if they've had their own experiences and they want to share the information. And I found that out of every sort of 15 or 20 or so reports that I would get, there would always be a couple of cases where somebody would say something along the lines of, well, I had what sounds like a Men in Black encounter, but it involved a woman, or there was a man and a woman turned up at the door. And over time, I realized this was sort of very much like an untapped aspect of the UFO subject that had sort of gone pretty much under the radar, so to speak, for so long. And over time, you know, I built up more and more reports from people who had, you know, were sharing their information with me, primarily because, you know, they knew I did work in the field of the Men in Black mystery. And finally, the point came this year when there was sort of enough material to warrant a full-length book on the subject.
Now, people, I think, who follow these topics as closely as you do, they're aware of these kinds of stories, and they kind of just set it aside. Yeah, that's really interesting, but I don't know what's going on. And they go off chasing flying saucers and writing about, you know, metallic nuts and bolt craft. But this is a really creepy aspect of this whole larger mystery. In the beginning of this book, you sort of paint the picture of how many different kinds of explanations for MIBs, in this case, WIBs, there are. Give us a laundry list, sort of a primer on what the possibilities are.
Mm-hmm. Well, ironically, given like the Men in Black movies, the least likely scenario is that they're government agents. They don't come across like that at all. You know, that's like furthest away you can think of. But the theories that have been put forward are sort of alien-human hybrids, extraterrestrials that eerily parallel, you know, the way we look, very close to us. Other theories include paranormal entities of some sort, you know, the idea that from the future. The theories sort of are multiple ones, and for the most part, they all have sort of supernatural or paranormal aspects attached to them. But at first glance, of course, just the terminology as it relates to the Men in Black, people assume we're talking about, you know, somebody straight out of the Pentagon, which is actually not the case at all.
It just always seems the classic story is they're just a little bit off, that they wear human clothes, but they it's ill-fitting. They don't seem to know how to react in social circumstances. They don't know what to do with food and drink. They can speak our language with some degree. But everything is just a little tiny bit off, and I wonder if that's on purpose or they're just incapable of quite getting it down, trying to pretend to be human.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that, I mean, if it's not done to sort of just freak people out, which isn't impossible because, you know, people do have a very sort of odd reaction, you know, like a frightened reaction, unsettling reaction to these Women in Black, purely and simply because, as you say, they don't act like normal people. But I don't think it's done for effect. I think there is something about them that is sort of very different to the rest of us. I mean, they typically described as looking sort of very pale, and as bizarre as it sounds, they often wear these long black wigs, sometimes as if it's literally trying to camouflage their faces, if you like, so we don't get a good look at them. And one of the weird things is sometimes they're very tall or they're quite short and skinny and pale, as I said. And when you put all those issues together, combined with the fact that they don't really somehow understand our mannerisms and our ways of talking, etc., you begin to realize that they're so different to us that it's almost, you know, to an incredible degree, as if somebody has almost like constructed something that looks human but has none of the basic human faculties, if you like.
I think there's also a perception, inaccurate as it turns out after reading this book, that the MIB type encounters or WIBs were all back in the 50s and 60s. They don't happen anymore. That is not the case, right?
Yeah, that's an important point, actually, George, because whether it's, you know, due to, particularly the Men in Black, you know, the old-style clothing, the fedoras and the suits, etc., people do assume that because this was such a high-profile issue in the 50s and through the 60s, when, as you mentioned, people like John Keel were looking into this, and people assume that, you know, they've gone away. But as I said, having done three books on the Men in Black and one on the Women in Black, I can tell you for sure that that's not the case. I get reports regularly from this year, from last year, and the, you know, throughout the 21st century. And what I found is that the descriptions of both the Women in Black and the Men in Black are pretty much identical to today. You know, the typical black suits, the pale skin, they still, rather bizarrely, turn up in sort of old style 1950s Cadillacs, black Cadillacs. And the means by which they sort of threaten people hasn't changed. You know, they knock on the door late at night, person opens the door, and they somehow feel almost sort of hypnotized into letting them in. And then there follows this sort of vague threat, or it's not always a direct threat, it's always sort of a little bit couched in mystery. But the gist of it is that they warn people still today not to talk about UFO encounters, and then they vanish as mysteriously as they first appeared.
Describe for us who they pick, who they target. These are people who've had their own encounters, who've seen something weird in the sky. Maybe it's on their mind. They're thinking about it a lot. If not, they've had their own encounters. It also happens to people like John Keel or others who are tracking down the mystery, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's sort of like a twofold thing. Both the women in black and the men in black target not just UFO witnesses or experiences, but also people in the community as well, sort of researchers and investigators. And one of the things I've found is that, you know, the first assumption is that it's just surrounding UFOs. And for the most part, you know, the women in black do target people who've had UFO experiences, such as abductions, close encounters, somebody may have seen a UFO land, or had sort of multiple encounters, and they get visited. However, as I point out in the book, there are examples where women in black and men in black have turned up in relation to sightings of strange creatures like Mothman, like Bigfoot, and bizarrely, even the Loch Ness Monster. I talk about all these scenarios where people have had these sort of strange encounters with, you know, sort of unearthly animals, if you like, and they've been silenced. I've also got a few cases in the Women in Black book where people have been dabbling with Ouija boards, and it was as if they'd sort of opened a doorway or a portal, and then in the early hours of the morning, they sort of semi-wake up to see this shadowy woman in black looming over the bed. So, in other words, it certainly starts out as a phenomenon where we assume it sort of revolves around just nuts and bolts, UFOs, etc., but it goes off into some very strange and alternative areas.
We're going to go to a break in about 2.5 minutes, but I want to go ahead and plunge into Albert Bender. This guy is sort of like, in a way, the father of MIBs, a key researcher, the guy who helped popularize this whole thing. You really dig into his personal life. It goes way beyond what I ever knew about the guy. Tell us who he is. Set it up sort of about the women in black angle, and then we'll get into some specific stories on the other side.
Okay. Well, yeah, Albert Bender was the one person more than anyone else who really kick-started the Men in Black mystery. He actually only died earlier this year at the age of 94.
Oh, wow.
But he left the UFO subject a long, long time ago. What happened was he created this UFO research group in the early 50s called the International Flying Saucer Bureau in his hometown of Bridgeport, Connecticut. All was going well for a year or so, and you know, he had numerous followers and people subscribing to his newsletter. And then suddenly, without warning, he closed it all down amid rumors that this trio of guys in black suits had warned him to keep away from the UFO subject. And such was the sort of terror that they'd instilled in him, Bender did exactly that. He walked away from the subject, only very briefly came back to it to write his own book to set the record straight in 1962 called Flying Saucers and the Three Men. And in that particular book, Bender's Men in Black are described as very odd, almost sort of supernatural, where they would literally sort of materialize in his bedroom in this sort of shadowy form, and they would have these strange glowing eyes. And it would all be amid this overpowering odor of like sulfur or brimstone, which is something that gets reported in a lot of paranormal encounters. But the reason I talk about Bender in the book was not just to set the scene, but because in his family there was a tradition and a story of this mysterious woman in black in the Bender family as well.
Describe his, and we got, I guess, about a minute, but describe his attic, because that becomes a key as we move through this story.
It does. Well, yeah, Bender lived in this old house in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and he lived in the attic part of the house. And he was someone who had a deep interest in not just the world of paranormal and supernatural in fiction. He was a big fiction fan of like H.P. Lovecraft, Bram Stoker, Edgar Allan Poe, etc. However, he was also very knowledgeable in the field of the occult in reality. And he essentially turned this attic room into what he himself called this chamber of horrors. And he created this so-called paranormal altar, where he would use sort of ancient rites and rituals to try and summon up supernatural entities.
On that note, I'm sorry to cut you off there, Nick, but it was just starting to get good. We'll pick up that part of the story in just a moment. We're talking with Nick Redfern about Women in Black, the creepy companions of the mysterious MIB. Jeff Beck, Ain't Superstitious, takes us into the break. Judas Priest, cranking it out, another thing coming. We're talking with Nick Redfern about his chilling new book, Women in Black, The Creepy Companions of the Mysterious MIB. This is not a phenomena that just affects UFO witnesses, as Nick just told us. One of the spookiest stories in the book is about a guy named Colin Perks, an Englishman who died prematurely in 2009, and his focus was King Arthur. He was looking for the burial spot for King Arthur. And somebody showed up at his door and told him some pretty strange stuff about King Arthur's burial place. And the people who showed up were women in black. We're going to get into that story, continuing our conversation about Albert Bender and his very weird attic in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Back with Nick Redfern talking about Women in Black, in particular, a case involving Albert Bender. So this Albert Bender was a major figure in ufology in the 1950s and 60s, and he just walked away from it, it turns out, because of an encounter he had. So pick up the story, Nick.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, the very fact that he was one of the sort of prime figures in the early years of ufology in the early 50s and then walked away from it all because of the Men in Black, it really sort of demonstrates how, you know, these encounters with the Men in Black and the Women in Black really can affect people's lives to where they become paranoid and terrified. And they do walk away from the subject. And that's exactly what Bender did, aside from coming back very briefly in the 60s to write this book called Flying Saucers and the Three Men, where the Men in Black in his book really come across far more like Edgar Allan Poe than they do Mulder and Scully. It's very much sort of like a gothic supernatural tale, but that interlinks with the UFO subject. Now, the reason why I mention Bender in the new book is not just because, you know, he gave birth, so to speak, to the Men in Black mystery, but within the Bender family, there was this long-standing story of a woman in black. And I don't think, you know, that can be coincidence. It's sort of a demonstration that even the person who kicked off and began the Men in Black mystery had the ties to the Women in Black. And the story was that one of Bender's cousins had an experience with a woman in black. At the time, he was a young boy and complained to his parents that for several nights he'd been woken up by this strange, creepy-looking, pale-faced woman in black, dressed in like a long kind of black flowing gown type outfit, that she'd been sort of looming over the bed. And he wore a chain around his neck with a small coin with a hole in it and the chain going through the coin. And he complained to his parents that the woman in black would try and steal this coin off the chain. And he would wake up in sort of a state of terror. And his parents told him that, you know, you're just having bad dreams. And but it went on and on. And eventually, the Bender's cousin's parents decided to sort of stake out the room at night. And sure enough, in the early hours, sort of about 2:30 a.m., they actually saw this bony, white-faced woman in black literally materialize in the bedroom. And they put the light on, and suddenly the woman in black just vanished into thin air, but not before she kind of glared at them, sort of angry that she'd been interrupted, so to speak. And again, as I said, I think there has to be a connection here with the Bender family and the Men in Black and the Women in Black. I don't think it's coincidental at all. But what it does demonstrate is that when we go looking, we find that even in the very earliest Men in Black stories and the key players in the phenomenon, that the women in black are actually an integral part of it when we go looking.
John Keel. Let's tell the stories about Keel. Of course, Keel was fearless. He traveled the world chasing all kinds of mysteries, cryptozoological, paranormal. He wrote some great stuff, best known for perhaps the Mothman book. But he had some encounters with these women in black, both, I guess, around him as well. Or somebody pretending to be women in black and pretending to be associated with John Keel.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the weirder aspects of the phenomenon, namely that when researchers go looking into these phenomena, they get visited by these black-suited figures as well. It's not just the witnesses. And Keel himself, as you mentioned, you know, quite rightly, he was the probably most famous for the Mothman prophecies, you know, his most visible and well-known book. And what happened with Keel was that the encounters that he had pretty much did revolve around Mothman. Now, the Mothman sightings actually began 50 years ago this year. It's just coming up to the 50th anniversary of the first Mothman sighting. And Keel, recognizing this was sort of a really interesting story as a journalist himself, he decided to look into it and spent literally months collectively in and around the Point Pleasant area investigating sightings of Mothman. And it was almost as if the act of investigating these things sort of tipped something on the radar of the women in black, and they started targeting him. And what happened, he found himself in a number of weird situations. One, where he would get weird hang-up phone calls in the middle of the night. You know, he would book into a hotel somewhere in town in Point Pleasant or on the fringes, and he'd be woken up in the early hours of the morning by these sort of weird phone calls with sort of electronic static noises or what sounded like a female voice speaking very, very quickly. Then he would get word from Mothman and UFO witnesses in and around Point Pleasant from people who claimed that they'd spoken to his secretary and wanted all the information of their encounters. And Keel had to explain to him and say, well, I actually don't have a secretary. So some mysterious woman was claiming to be his secretary to get hold of all the information that he was getting. And that's the most disturbing aspect of all, were the number of reports where people, again, in and around town, were being visited by women in black who claimed to be census takers. You know, they would knock on the door at night and they would quickly flash an ID card and say, we're taking a census for the government, can we come in? And they would start asking the typical questions, how many people live in the house, you know, what's the age range, what's the average income, etc. Then they would start to get into weirder areas and ask things about, have you had any strange dreams, what are your thoughts on the Mothman wave? And then the witnesses realize, well, hang on a minute, this isn't the sort of normal questions that a census taker would be asking. And so they would ask to see the ID card again, and then, of course, the women in black would quickly make their excuses and leave. But again, everybody said they sort of looked strange. They got sort of an odd vibe from them. And Keel chronicled a number of these cases, and it quite unsettled him when he found that he became part of the phenomenon rather than being sort of an outsider journalist covering the story. They began to target him as well.
You got a tale, I think it's via Keel, that I remember reading in your book about a lady named Helen who was, I think, 6 months pregnant. There was some really weird stuff that she conveyed to Keel. And she actually got not only threats, I guess, she got some kind of a warning that somebody was coming to her house. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, this is a really strange one because it's an interesting one because in many respects it sort of ties in with today's angles of so-called alien-human hybrids and, you know, the idea of hybrid babies. And it demonstrates that, in some respects, Keel was very much ahead of his time because this particular case involved various women that Keel was in touch with who had become pregnant. And in some cases, they thought they'd had a miscarriage, but then it was almost as if, well, it wasn't a miscarriage. It was almost as if the baby was somehow removed and stolen. And that's something that crops up a lot in of today's abduction stories, but it was barely spoken about, if at all, back in the 60s when Keel was getting these stories. And he was dealing with this one particular woman named Helen, who had a lot of strange UFO experiences and sort of visits to the home from these women in black, or they'd be prowling outside late at night. And the story got even more sinister when supposedly all these various women who got pregnant gave birth in this one particular isolated house. And the people in attendance at the birth were these sort of pale-faced, mysterious-looking women who helped to deliver the babies. And, I mean, it kind of sounds like some sort of bizarre, nightmarish story. And that's how Keel presents it. You can tell from his style of how he wrote the story that it deeply sort of disturbed him. The idea of these women in black actually going around assisting in women giving birth and then trying to steal the babies. And it's a very, very strange story, because I actually have a couple of chapters in the book which report almost identical scenarios from the 19th century, sort of like 1850s, 1860s, as if this has been going on for a very, very long time. And of course, when you sort of bring into the equation sort of pale-faced women in black stealing people's babies, then it gets into very kind of murky and disturbing realms.
Yeah, you've got a section where you deal with Welsh, I guess you could call it folklore, but maybe it's not folklore. Maybe it's something more than that.
Yeah, that's right. There were a spate of sightings of women in black in Wales between 1902 and 1910. And coincidentally or not, this coincided with an early UFO wave in Wales as well. Now, of course, back then they weren't known as UFOs or even flying saucers. People reported seeing strange balls of light in the sky in some of the little isolated Welsh villages. And within days of these encounters, and having spoken to the local newspapers, those people would be visited by women in black. And what's particularly interesting, if you look at the old newspapers, some of which I quote and where I relate the titles of the articles, they actually refer to them in the articles as the women in black. The titles are things like Mysterious Woman in Black Appears at Person's Home, or, Women in Black Seen Again in Welsh Village, things like that. And again, I think the notable thing is so many of these stories until now have just gone underappreciated or just not known about. And again, it's for me, it's sort of amazing that 70 years after almost Kenneth Arnold and Roswell, we're still coming across a relatively new and underappreciated aspect of the UFO phenomenon.
I can't remember where it is in the book, but I want to go back to this story I was trying to allude to just a couple of minutes ago. It was this pregnant lady who she got some kind of a phone call that told her to lock all her doors because the men in black or women in black were coming to her house.
Well, yeah, this is a very strange aspect of the story, because Helen, this particular woman, that's correct, she was told to lock all the doors because there were these women in black and men in black who were going to descend upon the house, and the inference was she was going to be kidnapped and possibly lose the baby. But the phone call came from another mysterious woman, which kind of suggested there were sort of two, almost like two opposing factions, one that were out to help her, and one that clearly didn't have her best interests at heart at all. And but again, it comes very much across like the today's stories of women losing babies, hybrid babies, and then them sort of being brought up, I guess, if you like, by aliens. And but for me, the most notable thing about this is that Keel actually wrote this article back in the 60s, but for reasons we don't know why, he didn't publish it. He held back on it. Perhaps he thought that even for him it was too controversial. But when we look at it in comparison to today's stories of hybrid babies and things like that, it actually fits in right in there, so you have to wonder exactly how long have these phenomena been going on for.
The best stories in your book are, of course, the ones where people have these conscious, very clear memories of what happened to them. But there are some encounters where things get a little fuzzy and that they seem to be under control of these women in black. The lady who ended up going to the library under directions from, I think it might have been a phone call. I can't remember if it was in person or in a phone call, but she went to the library and had a really strange sequence of events. Can you share that story?
Yeah, well, this actually deals with a woman named Jane who had an experience in the mid-1960s on the East Coast. And her and a boyfriend had been out late one night driving around town, and they had an experience of missing time. There was this sort of bright flash. They felt nauseous, passed out, and then, you know, typical scenario, they wake up hours later and realize that hours have gone by. And it was very much sort of, again, like the sort of abduction scenarios that people have today. But in Jane's case, there was a follow-up situation, as there, you know, there sometimes is when the men in black and the women in black are involved. And she received this weird communication informing her to go to a local library on one particular day. And it was a very sort of strange, you know, request. But nevertheless, she did that because she was aware that something strange had happened. And the caller alluded to the fact that they could help her, the woman on the other end of the line could help her understand what had happened to her. So she went along to the library. When she got there, the whole situation took on very sort of bizarre tones, if you like, because when she got to the library, it was deathly quiet and still, and there was a very good reason for it, that there was actually nobody in the library at all, apart from this strange-looking woman in black, dressed in what was described as a very old, sort of 1920s-type outfit that a woman would wear back then, you know, completely black. And she had long black hair, pale skin, and very kind of almost like emotional look on her face, emotionless look on her face, I should say. And the woman essentially told Jane that, you know, she would be receiving a series of messages and information that would allow her to understand the nature of the UFO phenomenon, and also would bring her into the program to a degree where she would be assigned various tasks, etc. And but for Jane, the creepiest thing about the story was the fact that on what should have been a busy day at the library and in a place where there should clearly have been more staff, she was in almost in like a weird vacuum type situation where reality had somehow shifted. And that was sort of the, you know, the strangest part of the story at all. But it gets even weirder because I talk in the book about two or three other women in black and men in black cases where they had been prompted to go to libraries. And when they arrived there, again, they were sort of isolated and empty, as if that nobody else could see her and she could not see anybody, or he could not see anybody else in the library. So, you know, there's very strange scenarios and situations like this where, as I said, it's almost as if reality shifts when the women in black are around.
It's like they go somewhere else. She walked into that library and it wasn't the same place that she'd visited before. And then when this incident ends, she walks out of the room where she was and suddenly there's regular librarians are there who weren't there before, right?
Yeah, and then slowly, sometimes, you know, reality returns to normal. A classic case I mentioned in the book is a guy named Peter Rojovitz, who had a very similar experience in 1980 when he was doing research into the UFO subject, actually, in the library. And then suddenly, again, everything sort of became like a vacuum and isolated, and this elderly, sort of creepy old man dressed in black came up to him and started asking questions about UFOs. And Peter Rodriguez was actually very, very sort of freaked out by this because the appearance of the man in black coincided with the library suddenly going totally silent. And as he looked around, there was not a soul in there, not a single person other than this man in black looming over him asking questions about UFOs. Eventually the man left. And then over the next couple of seconds or so, things started to return to reality and sounds could be heard and then people were seen. But again, it was almost as if he was placed into some sort of, almost like a sophistic hologram type situation where the library actually wasn't the library. Or you know, he was placed in some sort of weird dreamlike state when the communication occurred. But for some weird reason, we get a lot of stories where the women in black seem to be attracted to libraries, and particularly old libraries as well. And you know, which just adds to the weird nature of the phenomenon.
There's a great story I mentioned a few minutes ago about the guy looking into King Arthur. There's an even spookier story about a connection to Richard Nixon. And then for those who are thinking this is all just tabloid nonsense, there was a major investigation by law enforcement in the UK, and this was not one or two cases. This was a widespread scare concerning the safety of children. We're going to get into those stories and more with Nick Redfern, talking about his new book, Women in Black, The Creepy Companions of the Mysterious MIB, The Eagles' Witchy Woman takes us into the break.